Most college towns pride themselves on being safe, tranquil escapes from the dangers of the world. That notion shattered forever on a cold November night in Moscow, Idaho, when four students were murdered as they slept, a crime that exposed chilling truths about evil hiding in plain sight. The suspect, a PhD student in criminology, believed he could outsmart every investigator. But one mistake unraveled his plan, sparking an international manhunt, a courtroom drama, and a desperate search for answers that would haunt both the victims' families and the public. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. A night like any other. Moscow, Idaho had always championed its reputation as a perfect college town. Neighbors knew each other's names, students congregated at familiar diners, and parents never worried when the sun dipped below the rolling wheat fields. It was November 12th, 2022, a Saturday, and the energy of game day still vibrated in the air. Friends drifted between houses and parties, conversations filled with laughter, and plans for Thanksgiving break. The air was crisp, carrying the scent of pine and distant fireplaces. Inside a cozy multi-level rental home on King Road, four University of Idaho students converged after a night out. Madison Mogan, radiating confidence and quick wit, uploaded one last photo to Instagram, her blonde hair cascading, arm linked with her best friend, Kaylee Goncalves. Kaylee, adventurous and fiercely loyal, had returned home unexpectedly, her excitement about new beginnings barely concealed. Zana Knodel, with her gentle humor and welcoming nature, brought energy and laughter wherever she went. Her boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, an athletic, easygoing triplet, was just as much a staple in the house as its original residents. Each friend zigzagged through their own routines that evening. Uber rides, visits to the corner club, snacks from a food truck, whispered confessions, and the little rituals college students perform at the end of a Saturday night. Upstairs, Kaylee and Madison settled in. Downstairs, Zana and Ethan chatted in the kitchen, quiet enough not to disturb others. In the background, roommates in lower-level rooms wound down, scrolling through phones and sending goodnight texts. The house was aglow with a sense of safety. For these 8 hours, the rest of the world fell away. No worries about deadlines, the news, or what might come next. Even with the kerfuffle and shouts outside after midnight, standard weekend sounds on a college street, no one questioned their security. It was the kind of night that could have belonged to anyone, anywhere. Mundane, memorable, unremarkable in its fleeting comfort. But as the clock crept past 4 a.m., a series of small, unnoticed details would forever splinter the life these students had built. Unknown to anyone within those walls, something had already shifted in the darkness outside. A presence that would turn every ordinary moment into something unthinkable. When morning came and sunlight streamed across the quiet campus, the illusion of safety was gone. The house was still, untouched by the early sounds of student life. Calls to friends went unanswered. Doors sat unopened. Moscow would soon discover just how fragile the boundary was between sanctuary and nightmare. Chapter 2. Discovery and Panic. The morning of November 13th, 2022, arrived with a wintry hush, grey light spilling over the rooftops and quiet, frost-tinged lawns. All seemed ordinary along King Road, except for one student house where sunlight failed to ignite movement. What should have been a slow start after a Saturday night was instead an eerie, unbroken stillness. Inside the house, lower-level roommates woke to the quiet and confusion. Messages to their friends, Zana, Ethan, Madison, Kaylee, went unanswered. Doors that typically resonated with laughter and shuffling feet felt impossibly silent. The roommates tried calling out, knocking on bedroom doors, then reaching out again by text. By late morning, anxiety edged into fear. Panic rising, the roommates contacted friends for help, seeking comfort, hoping to break the uneasy spell. A group of them gathered, crowding the ground floor, searching desperately for explanations. That's when someone ventured upstairs and was met with a traumatic, incomprehensible scene. Blood trailing on floors, motionless bodies, a silence that screamed beneath the frantic pulse of incoming phone notifications. A 911 call went through to the Moscow Police Department. Officers arrived at 1122 King Road just before noon. The responding officers, seasoned but unprepared for such horror, stepped into chaos. The first responders' faces paled at the brutality. Four young students, their lives violently ended. Panic quickly spread from the house to the street as news trickled out. A cluster of police cruisers, yellow tape unfurled, neighbors staring from their porches. Word spread swiftly. The university issued a shelter-in-place alert, and parents in distant states frantically called their children. Students from surrounding homes gathered, faces streaked with tears, some trembling with shock and disbelief. Few were prepared for what officers shared privately that first day. This was no accident or isolated dispute, but a massacre. Multiple victims, apparently slain as they slept. Within hours, reporters swarmed Moscow, transforming the sleepy college town into the epicenter of a true crime nightmare. Anxiety settled over the university campus. Doors that once stood open were now double-locked. In living rooms and libraries across Idaho, an unshakable fear took hold. If it could happen here, it could happen anywhere. For the victims' families, the world no longer made sense. Their children's names, Madison, Kaylee, Zana, Ethan, were suddenly everywhere, shadowed by words no parent should ever hear. Words like homicide investigation, words like crime scene. The tight-knit college community reeled as rumors circulated, answers nowhere in sight. As dusk fell that Sunday, blue and red police lights continued their silent vigil outside the King Road home. Grief counselors arrived at the university. Students wept together in candle-lit clusters, searching each other's faces for hope or reason. Grief, panic, and disbelief swelled into a single, inescapable question. Who could have done this? And why? The hunt for answers, and a killer, had truly begun. Chapter 3. Shattered Community. The shockwaves from King Road rippled outward, changing Moscow, Idaho forever. News vans lined the block, their satellite dishes pointed skyward. Strangers, wrapped in heavy coats, whispered among themselves near the yellow police tape. The air, once filled with laughter and routine, hung heavy with questions no one could answer. Grief, fear, and confusion pooled together in the spaces where ordinary life had once flourished. On campus, classes were abruptly cancelled. Professors sent emails filled with both condolences and apologies, while students huddled in dorm lounges or retreated to the safety of their bedrooms. Small comfort could be found in shared tears and stories about the four friends now gone. Memorials began to sprout at the foot of the administration building. Flowers, candles, handwritten notes, and stuffed animals became unsanctioned tributes to Madison, Kaylee, Zana, and Ethan. Their faces, smiling in photographs, stared from news reports and missing posters, now repurposed as emblems of collective loss. Parents arrived from all over the state, their presence grim and urgent. They met with university leaders behind closed doors, demanding answers authorities could not provide. Law enforcement, hampered by the media frenzy, worked under intense scrutiny. Reporters asked the same questions over and over. Was there a suspect? Did the victims know their killer? Was the town still in danger? For now, all police could offer was a plea for patience, even as rage and fear simmered beneath the surface. At the center of the unfolding agony stood the victims' families. The Goncalves clung together, refusing to leave town until they had answers. The Mogan, Kernodal, and Chapin families drew strength from each other, alternately comforting and breaking down. Media requests became relentless, and every public statement felt like navigating a minefield, balancing grief, privacy, and the desperate hope that someone, somewhere, had seen something useful. The wider Moscow community felt the tremors. Churches opened their doors for vigils and counseling. Local businesses posted signs etched with supportive messages. Some questioned whether to remain in town at all, while others became fiercely protective, unwilling to let fear define their home. As each new rumor spread, a white car seen near the scene, an unfamiliar face reported on campus, Moscow's tight-knit bonds were tested, but not fully undone. Through tearful interviews and press conferences, the story of four young lives began to take shape for the world. They were not just statistics. They were children, friends, dreamers, siblings, and soulmates. Each had left a mark on their world, and each would become a symbol of the community's broken innocence. As night fell once again, the campus glittered with hundreds of candle flames, a vigil against the sudden darkness. Collective sadness mingled with uncertainty, yet also with a fragile sense of unity. Together, Moscow braced for what lay ahead, knowing that from this day forward, nothing would ever be the same. Chapter 4. The Investigation Begins. The moment the police finished sealing off King Road, Moscow's small-town mystery transformed into a sprawling, high-pressure crime investigation. Detectives and forensic teams descended on the scene, their faces set against the cold as they combed through the silent house, searching for answers amid the chaos. Camera flashes and hushed voices filled the front yard. Law enforcement stood guard, determined, if shaken, by the horror awaiting inside. Inside 1122 King Road, forensic investigators photographed everything. Beds unmade, spilled coffee, phones on nightstands, the echo of college routine frozen by violence. The sheer brutality of the scene was staggering. Blood-stained bedsheets and walls whispered the story of a killer who acted with shocking speed and intent. Detectives pieced together the victim's last movements, logging times, social media posts, and phone records, desperate to make sense of the timeline. Early on, a crucial clue surfaced, an empty knife sheath lying partially hidden near one of the victim's beds. Embossed with military insignia, it felt wildly out of place, a chilling marker left behind by the killer. Forensic technicians delicately collected samples, dusted for fingerprints, and searched desperately for DNA. The knife itself, however, was gone. Outside, a command center sprang up almost overnight. Adrenaline kept investigators awake as leads poured in. Officers went door to door, hoping to spot a broken lock, hear an echo of raised voices, or find security camera footage that might capture a shadow, a car, or anything that didn't belong. The gravity of the case demanded more. Moscow police called in the Idaho State Police, and within days, the FBI lent their expertise. The shared goal was clear: find the killer before fear crashed into full-blown panic. The investigation faced another obstacle: the lack of forced entry. No broken hinges, no smashed window panes. It appeared, at first glance, that the perpetrator might have been let in or entered through an unsecured door, an unsettling possibility that complicated the list of potential suspects. Detectives combed through the victim's digital footprints, tracing social circles, ex-boyfriends, acquaintances from campus parties, and even online followers. Anyone with a link to the victims became a person of interest, but nothing seemed to fit. Meanwhile, forensic specialists worked around the clock in local labs. The knife sheath was tested and retested for traces of DNA. Bits of hair, fiber, and other microscopic evidence were analyzed with increasing urgency. One blood sample, found near the sheath, did not match any of the victims. Quietly, hope flickered. If the DNA belonged to the killer, it could be the key to everything. By week's end, the investigation was both methodical and frantic. Each clue uncovered more questions. Each hour lost risked letting a killer slip further away. Behind closed doors at the police department, whiteboards crowded with names and timelines, evidence pointing everywhere and nowhere all at once. For the investigators, it was clear. This crime would demand the best of their skills, the toughest resolve, and perhaps a sliver of luck. The real hunt for a suspect had begun, kicking off a race against fear, frustration, and the relentless pressure from families desperate for closure. Chapter 5. The Mystery Roommates and the Timeline. By the end of the first week, the focus of the investigation widened to absorb every detail of the students' last night. Law enforcement pored over cell phone records, surveillance cameras, and social media posts, assembling fragments into a complex timeline. Two lower-level roommates, unharmed but now living with trauma, became key witnesses. Their recollections, though fragmented and colored by shock, offered both hope and confusion. The roommates described hearing noises during the night, what they first assumed to be the usual sounds of friends coming home late from parties or a television left on. One remembered hearing footsteps above, drifting voices, and a sudden, heavy thud. The next morning's eerie silence, the unanswered texts, the sense that something was off, the girl's recollections helped investigators pin down a window of time when tragedy struck. Cell phone data drew a rough map of the victim's movements from Saturday evening through the early hours of Sunday. Madison and Kaylee had gone out to a nearby bar, visible on security cameras, around 1:30 a.m. Video footage from local businesses and the street caught glimpses of them walking together, arms linked, laughter nothing unusual in a college town. A little later, they stopped by a food truck, chatting with acquaintances and checking their phones. Zana and Ethan followed their own routine, an off-campus party, then home together. Surveillance footage caught Ethan's car parking outside their house just before 2 a.m. After that, the trail went mostly dark. Messages sent and received in the early hours became the last digital footprints the victims would ever make. At 4 a.m., phones registered one final burst of activity. Calls went unanswered. After this, the timeline went blank, broken only by the evidence left in the stillness of the crime scene. The police determined that the killings took place shortly after this hour, coinciding with when the house fell silent for good. Investigators cross-referenced these details with the lower-level roommates' accounts. One remembered opening her door in the night and seeing a shadowy figure gliding through the hallway, though nothing at the time seemed threatening enough to draw immediate alarm. Another was frozen by confusion and fear, heard crying, a voice whisper, "It's okay, I'm going to help you," and footsteps exiting out the sliding glass door. Still, without clear faces or voices, the puzzle remained unsolved. In reconstructing the timeline, law enforcement also pinpointed when a white sedan, spotted repeatedly by neighborhood cameras, drove by the house, circled, and stopped briefly nearby. The car's significance hadn't yet solidified, but would become crucial in the days ahead. With every new detail from phone data, neighbor interviews, and camera footage, the landscape of the case sharpened. The movements and memories of survivors formed the bones of a timeline that would anchor the prosecution and eventually bring the search for justice into sharper focus. But at this point, despite long hours and mounting evidence, the question at the core of it all, who had entered the house and why, remained maddeningly unanswered, haunting the survivors and investigators alike. Chapter 6. Public Frenzy and Theories. As the days ticked by, with the case still unsolved, a restless energy gripped Moscow and, increasingly, the rest of the nation. Online forums erupted with speculation, true crime podcasts dissected every scrap of public information, and amateur sleuths pounced on leaks and rumors. With the media stationed on every corner, the once sheltered college town felt like the set of an unfolding crime drama, every moment saturated with anxiety and intrigue. The Moscow Police Department, under mounting scrutiny, struggled to balance public communication with protecting the integrity of the investigation. Press conferences became daily rituals, law enforcement spokespeople facing a barrage of questions from journalists and concerned residents. Each official statement was parsed, debated, and often misinterpreted. Rumors of multiple suspects, love triangles, family feuds, and secret motives flooded social media. Strangers followed trails that led nowhere, while some locals, tired of the attention, clamored for privacy and normalcy. The families of the victims became reluctant figures in the glare of public interest. In television interviews and emotional press releases, they made desperate appeals for information and pleaded for restraint from online speculators. Some lashed out at what they perceived as investigative delays, others turned inward, haunted by memories and what-ifs. The pain of waiting for answers, compounded by the scrutiny of strangers, became its own form of suffering. With a lack of immediate suspects, conspiracy theories flourished. Some pointed fingers at close friends or former romantic partners. Others analyzed traffic camera footage, frame by frame, searching for anomalies. In Facebook groups and Reddit threads, users mapped out potential escape routes, discussed possible motives, and even critiqued the police's every move. Among these voices were a few who, knowingly or not, spread misinformation, piling confusion atop grief. The investigation labored forward, weighed down by pressure, tips to chase, and a never-ending torrent of public questions. For detectives, each new theory, no matter how wild, had to be checked and cross-referenced against real evidence. Anonymous messages, citing reports, and even confessions came in, most useless, some requiring precious investigative time. Through it all, King Road remained blocked by police tape, its empty windows an ever-present reminder of the crime. Neighbors installed security cameras and reshuffled routines. At the university, enrollment in self-defense classes soared. The case had become a cultural phenomenon, a chilling mystery, shared grief, and a test of the town's resilience, all unfolding in the relentless spotlight of the digital age. But just as panic threatened to overshadow reason, a series of breakthroughs would soon begin to point investigators in a new direction, toward a suspect who had, until then, just blended into the background. Chapter 7. The Suspect Emerges. As the investigation reached a fever pitch, attention honed in on a new collection of seemingly unrelated clues. Amid the sea of dead ends, two discoveries would prove transformative: the presence of a specific vehicle and the critical DNA left behind at the crime scene. The white sedan. Surveillance footage had, for days, shown a white sedan cruising through the immediate neighborhood multiple times in the early hours of November 13th. The car, a Hyundai Elantra, was seen circling the block, slowing as it approached King Road before eventually disappearing. Investigators combed through hours of grainy video until their confidence grew. Identifying this vehicle and its driver could be the break the case needed. Local police, paired with the expertise of state and federal agencies, traced Elantras in the region, checking registrations, interviewing owners, and reviewing traffic camera data from miles around. It was a mammoth effort, reflecting the gravity of the situation and the community's desperate call for answers. The DNA trail. Meanwhile, forensic scientists made a parallel breakthrough. The knife sheath left near one of the victims had yielded a DNA sample that did not match anyone in law enforcement databases. This, coupled with advanced genetic genealogy techniques, allowed investigators to start tracing the DNA thread through online ancestry records and public genetic databases, a process that had solved other cold cases in recent years. Results, though preliminary, began to suggest a link to a family hundreds of miles away in Pennsylvania. The scope of the investigation began to shift, now stretching far beyond Idaho's borders. A criminology student in the spotlight. Their combined efforts began to zero in on Brian Koberger, a 28-year-old criminology PhD student living just across the state line in Pullman, Washington. Koberger, with a keen interest in criminal behavior and forensic analysis, had recently moved from Pennsylvania to the Pacific Northwest. On paper, he was an unlikely suspect. But as detectives combed through his digital footprint, a pattern of unsettling behavior emerged. Koberger had routinely visited or driven past the King Road neighborhood in the months leading up to the murders. Cell phone tower data showed his device pinged near the victim's house on several occasions, including shortly before and after the time the killings occurred. His online activity included posts about the psychology of criminals and the experiences of those who plan and execute violent acts. While nothing was yet conclusive, the convergence of digital, physical, and genetic evidence brought Koberger to law enforcement's immediate and intense scrutiny. Zeroing in. With mounting suspicion, but without enough for an immediate arrest, authorities continued surveilling Koberger. They observed his behavior, movements, and communications, hoping for more substantial evidence. A final stroke of luck came when law enforcement, trailing Koberger to Pennsylvania, where he had returned for the holidays, recovered DNA from household trash outside his family home. Laboratory analysis confirmed what they suspected. The DNA was an unequivocal match for the profile found on the knife sheath. Now, the mystery that had consumed Moscow suddenly felt one step closer to a solution. A suspect was in view, and the groundwork for an arrest, and eventually, justice, had been irrevocably laid. For the town, the victims' families, and a nation in suspense, the story was finally shifting from confusion and rumor to the cold illumination of truth. Chapter 8. The Arrest. On December 30th, 2022, as dawn crept over the Pennsylvania hills, a convoy of unmarked vehicles quietly surrounded a modest family home. Inside, the Koberger family had little idea that months of tireless investigation were about to converge on their doorstep. With methodical precision, law enforcement moved in. Brian Koberger, the quiet PhD student who had traversed the country for holiday break, was placed under arrest. First stunned, then eerily composed as he faced the reality of the accusation. The arrest was the result of weeks of painstaking surveillance. After linking the DNA from the crime scene to familial samples retrieved covertly from the household garbage in Pennsylvania, the Idaho team had briefed local police and coordinated with the FBI. They feared he might flee, destroy evidence, or even attempt to harm himself once he realized how close the net had tightened. News of the arrest sent a jolt through both Moscow and the greater true crime community. Camera crews, Journalists and bystanders crowded the normally quiet street as police led Koberger, restrained and stoic, to a waiting vehicle. Across the country, families of the victims gathered, huddled together in cautious relief, one step closer to justice, but still facing the uncertainty of a long legal battle ahead. The awaited announcement. Within hours, police departments in Idaho and Pennsylvania held joint press conferences, a palpable sense of accomplishment mixed with ongoing caution. Authorities emphasized the importance of due process and reminded the public that Koberger was presumed innocent until proven guilty. For the first time, they confirmed key investigative milestones: the DNA breakthrough, the role of the white Hyundai Elantra, and the cross-state strategy that led to the suspect's identification. Reporters clamored for details, but law enforcement carefully guarded much of the evidence. What they did share crystallized the immense difficulty of the case, from tracking cell phone pings across state lines, to monitoring suspect communications and digital activity, to the relentless work inside lab and field. The arrest, they admitted, was only the beginning of what would be a high-profile, complex prosecution. The reaction. On the University of Idaho campus, word of Koberger's arrest brought somber relief. Vigils were again held, flowers piled higher at makeshift memorials. In classrooms and coffee shops, students debated the implications. How could someone so versed in criminal psychology have committed such an act? What warning signs had been missed? For the first time in weeks, a sense of hope flickered, tempered by the knowledge that real closure remained out of reach. Families of the victims were both comforted and shattered anew by the details that emerged. In emotional interviews, they expressed gratitude to investigators, lawyers, and the community that refused to let the case go cold. In the same breath, they voiced a resigned fear. Would this arrest bring answers to the central mysteries? Would justice feel satisfying or forever incomplete? Extradition and the next chapter. Koberger waived his right to contest extradition and was soon flown to Idaho in discreet, high-security transport. Images of the handcuffed suspect arriving at the small county airfield rekindled the media firestorm. In the days that followed, prosecutors detailed the charges: 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of felony burglary. Koberger's expression never gave way to panic or anger. Instead, he faced the legal process with a clinical detachment, fueling new rounds of press discussion about motive, psychology, and premeditation. The stage was set for a protracted legal battle. Evidence would be scrutinized, defense and prosecution assembled their teams, and the eyes of the world remained fixed on a small Idaho courthouse. For a community battered by grief and disbelief, the arrest marked both a turning point and the beginning of another arduous chapter in the search for truth. Chapter 9. The Hunter Unmasked. Brian Koberger's arrest raised a chilling question. How could a criminology student, someone devoted to studying the darkest corners of human behavior, become the architect of such horrific violence? The layers of his background slowly unfolded as investigators, journalists, and legal experts pieced together the man behind the headlines. Academic and psychological profile. Koberger was a 28-year-old pursuing a PhD in criminology at Washington State University in Pullman, just a stone's throw from Moscow, Idaho. His academic focus was intense. He delved into the psychology of violent offenders, studying what drove individuals to murder and the tactics law enforcement used to catch them. This knowledge should have been a shield against making the same mistakes, but instead, it served as a dark fascination with the mechanics of crime. His academic papers showed an obsession with criminal minds and forensic methods. Professors described him as meticulous, socially awkward, and at times unnerving in his quiet intensity. Diagnosed with autism and obsessive-compulsive disorder, Koberger's mental health history raised questions about his social interactions and emotional coping mechanisms. The perfect crime that wasn't. Forensic experts and prosecutors emphasized how Koberger executed the killings with startling precision, but faltered in small yet critical ways, those same details that led to his eventual capture. The choice of a knife and the manner of stabbing reflected a calculated, if brutal, method designed to avoid detection by law enforcement. Leaving behind a knife sheath bearing forensic evidence was a rare lapse, and underestimating the reach of DNA genealogy proved to be his ultimate undoing. Koberger's pattern of presence near the crime scene months before the murders suggested premeditation, possibly a ritualistic or experimental element to his crimes. Throughout the investigation, authorities noted his careful attempts to clean his vehicle and dispose of evidence, behaviors typical of someone trying to avoid police detection, but also betraying his own anxiety and panic under pressure. Behavioral insights. Psychological profiling by experts called attention to what some described as the dark psychology employed. Koberger's knowledge of criminal behavior may have fed into a dangerous game of cat and mouse with investigators. His silence during investigations and the trial hinted at a mind disengaged from empathy or remorse. Interviews with acquaintances painted a picture of a man socially isolated, but academically brilliant, whose fascination with death and violence blurred the boundary between study and obsession. Koberger's refusal to disclose motives sparked widespread speculation, from psychopathy to undisclosed personal grievances. The media and public reaction. The revelation that a criminology student could be the murderer sent shockwaves through academic circles and true crime enthusiasts alike. Commentators debated how someone so educated about crime could commit such acts, and whether knowledge can tempt some into crossing moral lines instead of keeping them away. Universities across the region re-examined safety protocols and mental health support for students, while victims' advocates voiced the risks of overlooking warning signs in seemingly quiet individuals. Moving forward. With Koberger unmasked, not only by his crimes, but also by the stark realities of his mind and motivations still shrouded in silence, the narrative shifted into legal arenas and moral debates. The community prepared for a courtroom battle that would test facts against psychology, law against pain, and justice against the lingering questions. The next chapters would reveal these struggles in full, the courtroom drama, the family's voices, and the final reckoning for a case that had held the nation's attention in a grip of fear, fascination, and sorrow. Chapter 10. The Pain of Loss. As courtroom hearings loomed and the world dissected every detail of the investigation, the ripples of grief hit Moscow with renewed, devastating force. The community was forever altered. The headlines might move to legal analysis, but those who lost loved ones lived the tragedy in a continuous, private loop. Families confront the unimaginable. The Goncalves family, already close-knit, found themselves navigating a spiral of pain. Kaylee's parents and siblings moved between numb devastation and bursts of longing, her laughter still lingering in voicemail messages, her image frozen forever in prom photos and social media snapshots. Madison Mogan's family traveled cross-country to be near the site of the vigil. Her mother described sleepless nights, haunted by unanswered questions, and the aching absence at every family gathering. Zana Kernodle's loved ones recounted her spirit, unbreakable, warm, always the first to comfort others. Ethan Chapin's twin siblings grieved not just their brother, but the future they had imagined side by side. At memorial services, classmates placed notes at the victims' favorite campus spots, while teammates and colleagues dedicated games, recitals, and class projects to their lost friends. Communal grief and remembrance. University of Idaho's campus became a living memorial. Vigils lit the night sky with candles in the victims' names. Murals and impromptu shrines stood as testaments to lives cut short. Students wrote letters, created art, and organized charity drives in honor of their classmates. Professors paused lectures to reflect, and support groups met weekly, offering solace where words failed. Churches and community centers provided counseling, their walls echoing with prayers and pleadings for strength. Survivors, roommates who discovered the horror, friends who missed that night's gathering by chance, wrestled with guilt and anxiety, walking campus with heavy steps and wary glances. The small-town innocence Moscow once enjoyed was buried alongside the victims, replaced by a reality too heavy for its streets to hold. The city's response? Local businesses offered meals and services to grieving families. There were public appeals for tolerance as media and curiosity seekers flooded into Moscow, and new safety measures were quietly debated at City Hall. University administrators formed a task force to boost campus security and mental health resources. Throughout, the victims' families spoke for their children in television interviews and written statements, their voices alternately trembling with anger and thick with heartbreak. They advocated not only for justice, but for the preservation of their loved ones' memories beyond a headline or criminal trial. Their raw honesty sparked a national conversation about college safety, grief, and the enduring toll of violent crime. Grief's echo. Even as the legal process started its slow churn, the community clung to remembrance, sharing stories, holding vigils, and lifting one another through the darkest days. Yet no ritual could repair the hole ripped through so many lives. Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana were everywhere and nowhere at once. Faces on posters, names in hashtags, yet missing from every family photo and future plan. Moscow, Idaho moved forward, but never forgot. The pain of loss became the thread binding the community, urging everyone, students, parents, neighbors, to protect, remember, and speak the victims' names with love and resolution. Chapter 11. Gathering Evidence. The initial rush of heartbreak and fear soon gave way to a singular goal: building an airtight case that would withstand the scrutiny of the nation and the rigor of the justice system. While communities mourned, investigators, prosecutors, and forensic specialists set about the careful, meticulous process of evidence gathering, every detail a potential linchpin in the upcoming trial. Forensic science at the forefront. The King Road crime scene remained sealed for weeks. Expert teams in protective suits moved methodically through the house, re-examining every inch. Swabs, fibers, fingerprints, and digital evidence were logged, analyzed, and cross-referenced. The knife sheath, tested repeatedly, yielded a genetic profile that withstood every challenge of laboratory validation. Analysts also tested blood samples, stray hairs, and trace skin cells for secondary matches, aiming to confirm the killer's movements and intentions. Digital forensics contributed a new dimension. Investigators combed the victim's phones, devices, and social media accounts to confirm last known contacts, call logs, missed messages, and app activity that formed the bedrock of establishing precise timelines. Koberger's own technology, phones, laptops, external drives, was seized and subjected to rigorous examination, revealing search histories and movements coded into cell tower pings and app data. The car, tracing movements. Detectives tracked Koberger's white Hyundai Elantra, reconstructing his route using traffic cam footage, GPS data, and witness statements. Video evidence showed the Elantra circling the area before dawn, then speeding away soon after the likely time of the killings. Forensic examination of the car revealed traces of blood, though not all could be definitively matched to the victims, raising new questions and avenues for expert testimony. Legal maneuvers and admissibility. As evidence stacked, legal teams for both prosecution and defense contested the methods and findings. The defense challenged the use of genealogical DNA techniques and argued over potential contamination of physical evidence at the chaotic crime scene. The admissibility of cell phone pings and digital footprints became a heated pre-trial battle, with the court weighing privacy rights against the overwhelming need for clarity and truth. The knife that was never found. While the sheath provided critical evidence, the murder weapon itself remained missing, fueling speculation and strategic arguments. Prosecutors believed the overwhelming circumstantial and scientific evidence would suffice, while the defense pointed to the missing blade as a possible source of reasonable doubt. Death penalty or life? Public debate surged over whether Koberger should face the death penalty. Prosecutors signaled their intent to pursue it, given the heinous nature and calculated planning of the crime, while defense attorneys prepared for a fight on both evidence and penalties. Families gave passionate, often conflicting, statements on the issue, dividing community opinion. Tireless pursuit. Through months of late nights, mounting paperwork, and expert consultations, the core investigative team pressed onward. As the case built toward trial, law enforcement and the families of the victims trusted in the growing mountain of evidence. Each piece, swab, ping, hair, photo, and digital trace, represented hope, a chance for justice, closure, and an end to the uncertainty that had suspended Moscow and the nation for far too long. The story of four young lives lost now moved inexorably toward the courtroom, where evidence, not just emotion, would determine fate. Chapter 12. Delayed Justice. As the initial wave of evidence collection slowed, the criminal justice process shifted into a grinding, procedural phase. The world outside Moscow pressed for rapid closure, but those closest to the case understood that justice is neither quick nor simple. For the families, each delay felt like reopening a wound. For the prosecution and defense, each day brought strategic calculation, preparation, and frustration. Waves of motions and legal maneuvers. With Koberger in custody, his legal team began to file a volley of motions. They challenged nearly every aspect of the prosecution's case. Suppression of DNA evidence sourced through genealogical databases, claims of improper handling of digital evidence, and the admissibility of witness testimony from traumatized survivors. Debates raged in pre-trial hearings, some public, most behind closed doors, over whether evidence should be excluded, whether certain testimony would prejudice the jury, and even whether the trial should remain in Moscow. Attorneys for the defense argued passionately for a change of venue. Local sentiment, fueled by ongoing media coverage and the university's ripple effects, made it impossible, they said, for Koberger to receive a fair trial in Latah County. Prosecutors pushed back, contending that the people of Idaho deserved to see justice done where the crimes had shattered the community. The toll of time. As months passed, anxieties multiplied. The victims' families, already weary from loss, braced themselves for a long year of legal wrangling. Some became vocal advocates for expediting proceedings, giving interviews to highlight their children's stories. Others retreated, finding the endless coverage and speculation too much to bear. On campus, time both healed and exposed new fears. Freshmen learned the campus's sad new history as a rite of passage, while upperclassmen returned to changed routines. Administrators announced initiatives, expanded mental health support, new security systems, and annual memorials for the victims. Yet for many, the weight of unfinished business hung over school events, football games, and graduation, a mournful undertone to every celebration. Media and public perception. The case's prominence brought its own brand of chaos. National and international news outlets camped outside the courthouse during hearings. Podcasters released episode after episode, dissecting court filings and strategy. The victims' families navigated this with mixed feelings. Some saw the media as critical partners in keeping the case alive, while others resented the intrusion into their grief. Rumors and leaks continued to swirl online. Each new docket entry was pored over by armchair detectives, sometimes clouding the court of public opinion and adding to the pressure on both sides to act quickly but thoughtfully. Preparing for trial. As the trial crept closer, tensions sharpened. Prosecutors assembled a multi-layered narrative using a timeline constructed from thousands of data points, digital, forensic, testimonial. Every piece of evidence was scrutinized not just for its investigative value, but for how a jury would perceive it, straightforward, unambiguous, and damning. The defense, meanwhile, prepared for a two-pronged fight, attacking the strength of the evidence and shaping public perception of Koberger. They conducted mock trials, rehearsed opening and closing arguments, and debated whether Koberger himself would testify. Divided community, shared vigil. As winter gave way to spring, the town of Moscow remained united by sorrow, but divided by hope and doubt. Some community members wanted swift, punitive justice, while others, wary of rushing due process, insisted on patience. Memorial gardens bloomed as silent reminders, while rallies and fundraisers spilled onto campus greens and courthouse lawns. The trial had yet to begin, but already its consequences were deep and irreversible. In Moscow and across the nation, the wait for true justice, delayed but still anticipated, became a collective test of faith, endurance, and the sometimes agonizing pace of the law. Chapter 13. Preparing for Court. By the time the first notes of spring drifted over Moscow, the city's focus had turned to an approaching crucible, the criminal trial of Brian Koberger. The wounds left by loss and delay had not healed, but hope for resolution began to stir as families, survivors, and legal teams prepared for their day in court. The families brace for testimony. Victims' families faced the daunting task of preparing statements for the jury. Each was asked to distill a world of memories, grief, and longing into a few powerful sentences, words that would become the heartbeat of the proceedings. Parents and siblings gathered in living rooms, sorting photographs and handwritten notes, struggling to express the depth of their loss and the futures forever changed. Counselors aided families and witnesses through sessions designed to build emotional stamina for public testimony. Some family members agreed to testify, determined to face Koberger directly. Survivors, the two roommates who had discovered the aftermath, prepared to recount memories sharpened by trauma and confusion. Prosecution's complex narrative. Prosecutors meticulously assembled their case files, structuring the narrative with painstaking care. Their goal, to weave together forensics, witness statements, digital evidence, and motive into a story that would move a jury beyond reasonable doubt. PowerPoint slides, physical exhibits, and a reconstructed timeline were prepared for a trial expected to draw national attention. Expert witnesses, including forensic analysts and behavioral specialists, were prepped and cross-examined in private mock trials. Prosecutors anticipated aggressive challenges from the defense, particularly around DNA sourcing, the failure to locate the murder weapon, and possible contamination of evidence at a crowded crime scene. Defense prepares its strategy. The defense team intensified its efforts, seeking to humanize Koberger and undermine the credibility of the prosecution's chain of evidence. They conducted practice cross-examinations, highlighted the gaps created by the absent knife, and readied arguments about alternative suspects or possible procedural errors. Ethical debates simmered in the background. Should Koberger testify in his own defense, risking cross-examination and further scrutiny? Or would silence serve him better? Community tensions rise. In Moscow, the trial dominated conversation. Many struggled between the desire for swift justice and fear that a rushed process could jeopardize the outcome. Security on campus and at the courthouse was visibly bolstered. The university arranged alternative class schedules to support those testifying or participating in vigils. Vigils and prayer circles intensified as the court date neared, with church leaders urging unity. Bars, coffee shops, and classrooms buzzed with speculation. Would the trial bring closure or only more pain? Final visits and unfinished business. The victim's parents made final visits to the King Roadhouse, now a somber landmark. They spoke quietly with prosecutors, reviewed their statements, and left offerings at the makeshift memorials. For many, these acts were as important as any legal preparation, a way to honor lives lost and brace hearts for the trial's emotional turbulence. The eyes of the world. As jury selection drew near, TV crews staked out the courthouse, satellite vans lining the block. The world watched, waiting for justice to unfold in a small courtroom where the stakes couldn't be higher. With evidence mounting and hope flickering through grief, Moscow steeled itself for the next chapter. The community, once defined by fear and confusion, now prepared to face the pain of truth, together and in court. Chapter 14, The Plea Deal, the legal chess match that dominated Moscow's attention, took a sudden, seismic turn just as opening statements were set to unfold. Weeks before the highly anticipated trial, word emerged from an unassuming conference room inside the courthouse. Brian Koberger, after months of stoic silence and steadfast preparation to contest every charge, was preparing to plead guilty to all counts. Behind closed doors. Negotiations had stretched deep into the night, lawyers drifting between guarded conference rooms and quiet hallways as families waited with uneasy anticipation. The prosecution, weighing the community's thirst for resolution against the enormity of pursuing the death penalty, offered a deal. In exchange for a full confession and a waiver of appeals, Koberger could avoid capital punishment and spend the rest of his life behind bars. Koberger's legal team, sensing the inevitability of conviction given the mountain of evidence, presented the agreement to their client. Families of the victims, previously divided on the death penalty's merits, were consulted. Some saw life imprisonment as the only acceptable end. No courtroom dramatics, no chance for Koberger to use the trial as a platform. Others craved the catharsis only a public reckoning could provide. The public announcement. On a brisk July morning in 2025, Koberger appeared in court alongside his attorneys, flanked by armed deputies. The room, packed with family members, reporters, and community leaders, fell silent as the judge read the charges: one count of felony burglary, four counts of first-degree murder. With the press of a microphone button, Koberger's voice finally broke the courtroom's silence. Guilty, Your Honor. He agreed to each count with a detached tone, refusing to elaborate or explain. The plea, entered on the record, sent ripples through the assembly. For the victims' families, it was both a relief and a heartbreak. Resolution at last, but with no answers to the questions that haunted them most. Immediate consequences. The plea deal triggered an immediate end to the trial. The jury, weeks in selection and preparation, was quietly dismissed. Prosecutors pivoted from battle mode to preparing for a sentencing hearing, where families would be able to confront Koberger directly. Now, the chance to read victim impact statements became the sole outlet for pain, fury, and memories. For Moscow, the plea brought both an end and a beginning. The legal saga that had gripped the community was concluding, but the hard work of healing had only just begun. National conversation. Commentators dissected the seismic implications of the plea. Some saw it as a rare victory for families, spared the uncertainty and media circus of a contested trial. Others lamented the loss of a public forum that could have forced Koberger to explain his motives. Attorneys praised the investigative teamwork that made a deal possible. Civil rights advocates questioned the ethics of plea bargaining in cases so grievous. Podcasts and news programs featured experts debating the legacy of the case, the value of closure, and the limitations of a system that can secure punishment, but not understanding. The victims remembered. Families prepared final tributes. The stories of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana echoing through statements to the court and the press. Signs, murals, and scholarships bearing their names proliferated across campus and throughout the region. For the first time in nearly 3 years, the town of Moscow felt the first hints of an ending, bittersweet and incomplete, but real. With the plea deal now sealed, focus shifted to the looming sentencing. The next chapter awaited. A courtroom testimony where every unanswered question, every memory, and every loss would be brought, one by one, into the light. Chapter 15. The Courtroom Drama. The long-awaited sentencing hearing became Moscow's defining moment of communal reckoning, a day when heartache, resilience, and the dogged quest for justice all converged inside a single wood-paneled courtroom. Security was tight. Outside, mourners, onlookers, and press stood in silent throngs, bearing candles and handwritten signs. Inside, every seat was filled by grieving families, friends, university faculty, and law enforcement officers who'd shepherded the case from confusion to closure. Opening statements. Judge Stephen Hippler presided, setting a tone both grave and compassionate. He reminded everyone of the gravity of proceedings and the need for composure. The prosecution began by recounting the evidence, the brutality of the crime, the overwhelming proof amassed by forensic teams, and the ripple of trauma extending far beyond King Road. Prosecutors paused frequently to let the weight of their words and the silence that followed speak volumes. Victims' families take the stand. The most searing moments belong to the families. Kaylee Goncalves' mother stepped forward first, voice breaking as she described a world without her daughter's laughter. Holidays forever marred by an empty seat, milestones unattended, nightly prayers for healing. Madison Mogan's father followed, clutching a favorite childhood photo, recounting dreams left unfulfilled, and the aching absence stretching into every tomorrow. Zanaka Nodal's sister struggled through trembling tears, telling of a sibling bond and stolen future plans. Ethan Chapin's twin siblings, a brother and a sister, knitted their statements together. Their loss a shared wound. Each word cut through the courtroom. We remember not how our loved ones died, but how they lived. Even the surviving roommates, previously shielded from most proceedings, chose to submit written statements. Each described waking nightmares, survivors' guilt, and lives divided into before and after. The prosecutor's closing argument. The prosecution concluded by painting Brian Koberger as a man whose actions tore the fabric of an entire community. They called for the maximum allowable sentence, declaring that anything less would cheapen the unthinkable pain inflicted upon so many. The defense response. Koberger's defense, having negotiated the plea deal, did little to plead for leniency. Instead, they acknowledged the mountain of evidence and deferred to the judgment of the court. Family members present for the defense stood quietly, faces unreadable, weighed by anguish of a different kind. Koberger's address and silence. Every eye in the courtroom turned to Koberger as Judge Hippler offered him one final chance to speak, not just for himself, but maybe to give the family some closure. After a long pause, Koberger simply said, "I respectfully decline." His refusal to explain or display remorse hardened some hearts, while others simply slumped under the weight of unanswerable questions. Judge Hippler's sentencing. Judge Hippler's words blended solemnity and indignation. He spoke of each victim, by name and by story, reminding everyone that justice was ultimately about their lost futures, not the notoriety of the crime or its perpetrator. Koberger was sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms without parole, plus an additional 10 years for burglary. The judge stressed there would be no possibility of future appeal or early release. The sentence was final. Unfathomable loss, answered only by society's strongest response. Aftermath. A courtroom changed forever. As the hearing concluded, families embraced, tears flowing freely. Reporters left quietly, respect finally winning out over spectacle. Outside, hundreds gathered, some speaking, some weeping, each holding on to the memory of Madison, Kaylee, Zana, and Ethan in their own way. Bells across campus tolled in gentle tribute. The trial chapter closed not with celebration or joy, but with a recognition of resilience through adversity. Justice, incomplete yet irrevocable, had finally spoken. Chapter 16. No remorse. The sentencing of Brian Koberger brought a measure of closure to a grieving town, yet left in its wake a vacuum, an absence where understanding and contrition should have been. The courtroom, so recently filled with raw testimony and trembling emotion, slipped into an uneasy calm. But for the families of the victims and the wider Moscow community, one fact became horribly clear. There would be no words of explanation, no remorse, from the man whose actions shattered so many lives. The unanswered question. As the room emptied after the verdict, many lingered, hoping for just a moment of insight, a look, a statement, any gesture revealing the killer's state of mind. Instead, Koberger remained a cipher, his silence resounding even louder than the judge's measured sentences. This refusal sparked a new wave of anger and heartbreak for the families. Without an explanation or apology, the search for meaning shifted inward, becoming deeply personal and, at times, painfully futile. Parents described recurrent dreams haunted by the same question. Why our children? Friends replayed the last conversations with the victims, searching for warnings they might have missed. The survivors, meanwhile, faced not only the trauma of that night, but also the agony of a court process offering neither clarity nor closure. The limits of justice. For the public, the case prompted reflection on the limits of the justice system. The process had delivered a verdict and ensured safety, but it had not delivered understanding. Community leaders, therapists, and faith counselors observed a pattern: grief compounded by mystery. The need for answers lingered as an unhealed wound, revealed in counseling sessions, memorial services, and street corner conversations. Local and national commentators questioned whether justice could ever truly be served in the absence of remorse or accountability from the perpetrator. Some took comfort in the certainty of Koberger's punishment. Others struggled, feeling that the lack of motive or explanation denied a sense of true closure. The broader impact. The university strengthened its commitment to campus safety and student well-being, organizing educational forums on mental health and criminal behavior. Candlelight vigils transformed from events of mourning into platforms for advocacy, calls for greater support for those grappling with trauma, and for systems designed to detect and prevent acts of violence. The news media, which had covered the story relentlessly, shifted focus to deeper analysis: the gaps in mental health support, the challenges of balancing privacy and vigilance, and the broader implications for other communities now facing their own shadows of vulnerability. Victims' families began channeling their pain into action, some founding scholarships, others organizing awareness campaigns, all determined to ensure that their children's memories would foster change. Moving forward. With each passing day, the community stitched itself together, sometimes in anger, more often in solidarity. The absence of remorse from the one person who could have answered their questions was met, time and again, by the resilience of the many. In living rooms, classrooms, and church halls, people gathered, telling stories, demanding better futures, and vowing never to forget the names and faces lost to a crime that had left so many questions hanging in silence. Chapter 17. Sentencing Day. The day the community had awaited, with a fraught mixture of hope, rage, and resignation, dawned under somber gray skies. Sentencing Day drew crowds to the courthouse, a building now etched into the town's collective trauma. For many, this was the last ritual before the slow, uncertain process of healing could truly begin. The scene at the courthouse. By early morning, a long line of mourners, press, and supporters wrapped around the courthouse steps. Protesters mingled with victims' advocates, their signs a tapestry of pain and solidarity. Police officers conducted security checks, their presence a reminder of the magnitude and volatility of the proceedings. Inside, every seat filled quickly. Journalists scribbled notes, cameras flashed, and heavy silence reigned until Judge Stephen Hippler took the bench. The families of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana sat together, united by shared loss. Prosecutors, defense attorneys, and counselors waited, tense but resolved. Formal proceedings. The hearing began with a summary of the plea agreement. The judge meticulously reviewed the terms. Brian Koberger would receive 4 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole for the murders of the students, plus an additional decade for felony burglary. Statements from the prosecution reiterated the overwhelming evidence: the brutality of the crime, the systematic efforts to evade capture, and the unmeasurable harm inflicted on families, friends, and the broader community. In a tone that blended outrage and sorrow, lead prosecutor Susan Rowe declared, "Today we speak for those who cannot. Justice cannot restore the lives taken, but it can ensure this horror is never revisited." Impact statements. One by one, the victims' families addressed the court. Some spoke with a trembling dignity, reading notes stained with tears. Others' voices rose with anger, the fury of lost futures, and unanswered questions breaking through composure. Parents recalled childhood memories: first days of school, birthday parties, winter holidays, now frozen in time. Siblings remembered private jokes, late-night talks, sports matches, and secret dreams. A mother's words. "We sentence you, Mr. Koberger, not only for what you did, but for every moment you just walked away from without regret. Our pain will not end with your punishment, but you will never again haunt our world." Students from the university stood to read letters on behalf of classmates, friends, and teammates. The impact of the night's events radiated across all of Idaho and beyond. The defendant. When given the opportunity to speak, Koberger again declined, his silence as chilling and immutable as the crimes themselves. His expression betrayed nothing, neither remorse nor triumph, and he faced forward as the judge delivered the final sentences. The judge's words. Judge Hippler's address marked a moment of moral gravity for the entire community. He acknowledged the tireless work of investigators, the courage of survivors, and the heartbreak of the families. "Your actions were deliberate and merciless. The consequences have been irreparable. For your choices, you will never again walk free." The sentences were delivered without possibility of appeal or parole, echoing into a tense, tearful hush in the courtroom. Aftermath and reflection. When proceedings ended, families and friends clung to each other, many sobbing. Outside, bells tolled, and the community gathered around the courthouse steps, some in silent embrace, others gently sharing stories. Local news carried the outcome live, and across town, restaurants, homes, and campus lounges echoed with the bittersweet news. Justice, however incomplete, had arrived. Though Koberger's silence lingered, the finality of this day allowed many to begin forging new definitions of closure. For Moscow, sentencing day was less an ending than a moment of reckoning, a pledge that the names and dreams of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana would endure, not as footnotes to tragedy, but as the enduring core of a town forever changed. Chapter 18, Aftermath. The sentencing may have signaled the end of a long and painful legal journey, but for the people of Moscow, the impact of that November night rippled forward, changing the community, the university, and the national landscape. University and community response. The University of Idaho mourned, then responded. Administrators implemented sweeping security upgrades, new surveillance systems, improved lighting, and a 24-hour campus safety line. Mental health teams expanded counseling hours, designed trauma recovery programs, and worked to destigmatize seeking help. Student leaders hosted remembrance events, each more focused on healing and advocacy than on reliving the tragedy. Faculty and staff, many of whom had known the victims or their families, adapted their teaching and outreach styles. Professors incorporated lessons on resilience and bystander awareness into coursework, while student clubs committed to annual acts of service in Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana's names. Calls for reform and reflection. Moscow's attention turned toward prevention and systemic change. Local law enforcement partnered with state agencies to create safer rental housing policies, increased patrols in student neighborhoods, and launched educational campaigns about digital self-defense. State lawmakers and community organizers debated the balance between privacy and the need for effective investigative tools. Discussions shaped both by the prosecution's use of genetic genealogy and the defense's privacy concerns. Victims' families became voices for reform. Some advocated for changes in laws around forensic evidence and mental health funding. Others poured energy into scholarship funds, campus safety audits, or public speaking, determined that their children's stories would not become cautionary tales, but catalysts for action. the echoes of justice. Podcasts, documentaries, and news specials continued to keep the case in the national spotlight. As the anniversaries of the tragedy passed, Moscow gathered in parks, alleyways, and university halls for moments of silence and new commitments to look out for one another. Parents from across the country, moved by the story's details, lobbied for better protection for their own children at colleges nationwide. University applicants, drawn by the school's response and the community's resilience, arrived with their own memories of fear and empathy. While some families chose to move away after the turmoil, others stayed, refusing to surrender their town to darkness. Grief's new shape. For survivors and the families of the victims, closure remained elusive. Memories were preserved in digital archives and physical tributes, but daily routines, meals, holidays, birthdays, remained marked by absence. Survivors and students who witnessed the aftermath forged unbreakable bonds, supporting each other through therapy, advocacy, and quiet acts of remembrance. Professors noted a new seriousness in classrooms, an increased attendance at campus safety trainings, and a budding determination to foster communities where safety and compassion were inseparable. Lessons and legacy. The aftershocks of the Idaho student murders redefined what it meant to be vigilant and compassionate in a close-knit town. While the wounds had not fully healed, the collective promise was this: the names of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana would live on, not only as victims, but as the reason Moscow stands more united, more watchful, and more determined to create a future where the unthinkable will never be repeated. Chapter 19, Lingering Questions. Moscow, Idaho, slowly stitched itself together after the upheaval of loss and the finality of sentencing. Yet in quiet corners, homes, classrooms, coffee shops, late-night gatherings, a single resonant ache lingered. Why? Even with justice served, some wounds could not be cauterized with the gavel's strike. The community and the nation were left facing a void where answers should have been. The motive that never emerged. Despite the extensive investigation, confession, and courtroom proceedings, Brian Koberger remained silent about his true motives. This absence left everyone, families, friends, journalists, survivors, spinning theories. Was it obsession, envy, a deranged experiment from a criminology mind, or something even more deeply buried? Profilers weighed in, debating everything from personality disorders to the possibility of ideological zeal. Academics pointed to the dangerous intersection of expertise and detachment, pondering the risk of those who study violence with an unhealthy fascination. Those closest to the victims struggled with cycles of acceptance and renewed rage. For some, the lack of explanation became its own lifelong torment, an unanswered question shadowing every birthday missed, every memory revisited. Survivors and families seek understanding. Unable to rewrite the past, the survivors and families did what they could with the present. Many dedicated themselves to advocacy, research, and public speaking, addressing issues of campus safety, mental health, and the unpredictable contours of grief. Others found solace in smaller acts, planting gardens in tribute, sponsoring scholarships, supporting young people struggling with trauma. Support groups and counseling communities grew, connected by stories of endurance and discovery. Some family members, after much deliberation, forgave Koberger in public letters, not to absolve him, but to reclaim control over their own healing. The impact on justice and society. National discourse, fed by endless media analysis, gravitated to questions with no easy resolve. How can law enforcement spot warning signs before it's too late, especially when those on the edge appear outwardly unremarkable? Are advances in forensic science and digital investigation enough, or must deeper investments be made in prevention and mental health? Should society brace itself for more killers who, like Koberger, blend knowledge and secrecy in chilling ways? Criminal justice reform advocates use the case to spotlight gaps, the need for better interagency information sharing, stronger mental health interventions in higher education, and a modern understanding of at-risk profiles. The community moves forward. Over time, new students arrived at the University of Idaho, and life, bit by bit, regained its rhythm. Ritual remembrance softened into reflection. Memorials found permanent homes in gardens and halls. Mentorship programs flourished, their banners bearing the names of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana. Local government worked with campus leaders to ensure that the events of November were neither ignored nor sensationalized, but taught honestly, as warnings, as lessons, as evidence of resilience. Unspoken bonds. At the heart of it all was a community forever transformed. Some scars remained invisible, only glimpsed in the wary way friends checked in on each other, or the weight added to words like safe and home. Moscow's story was no longer just about tragedy, but about how neighbors, strangers, students, and families chose to support one another in the ongoing absence of answers. Justice had been served, yet the questions endured. The legacy of the crime lay not just in what was lost, but in the courage to confront what cannot be understood, and to keep moving forward, together. Chapter 20. Legacy. The months and years following the trial found Moscow transformed not by tragedy alone, but by the ways its people chose to honor the four lives lost. Through their memory, the town discovered new depths of compassion, collective responsibility, and hope. Memorials and enduring tribute. Across the University of Idaho campus, physical reminders of Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana grew into lasting tributes. Scholarships were established in each victim's name, funding studies in subjects close to their hearts: education, nursing, sports, and the arts. Memorial gardens blossomed near the administration building, meticulously maintained by volunteers who gathered for annual plantings, choosing blooms in the victims' favorite colors. Commemorative walks and runs drew hundreds each year, channeling grief into community activism. Student leaders and faculty together launched an annual Day of Kindness and Awareness, where acts of service, campus safety workshops, and stories of resilience became traditions marked by solidarity rather than sorrow. Advocacy and awareness. The victims' families refused to let the end of the courtroom battle be the end of their public engagement. Their advocacy sparked statewide and even national conversations. Campus safety audits became standard at the university and inspired reforms across Idaho's higher education system. Mental health resources saw significant investment, with survivors and families participating in campaigns to destigmatize help-seeking. Educational forums on criminal psychology, digital privacy, and violence prevention drew experts from law enforcement, academia, and public health. Some family members and survivors took to the lecture circuit, sharing their experiences at conferences, schools, and civic events, not to recount horror, but to speak to the strength found in community response and the importance of vigilance. A changed community. The resonance of the crime did more than lead to new policies. It reshaped the very culture of Moscow. Neighbors became more closely connected, organizing block watches and support networks for students. local businesses and organizations initiated mentorship programs aimed at creating a safer and more nurturing environment for young people. Annual art and music festivals dedicated a portion of their programming to remembrance and healing, ensuring that the names of the victims were always woven into the community's future. National impact. The case led to tangible changes beyond Idaho. Universities across the country adopted integrated safety and prevention protocols modeled after those created in Moscow. State legislators in several regions introduced bills to enhance campus security, strengthen genetic privacy protections, and expand funding for mental health on college campuses. National conversations on the dangers of isolation, the complexities of motive, and the power of forensic science continued, often anchored in the legacy of these crimes. Remembering the victims. With each anniversary, reflection replaced somberness. Faculty, students, and citizens paused to read the victims' names and accomplishments aloud, planting new flowers, hanging ribbons, or simply sharing a moment of silence. The families encouraged the world not to remember Madison, Kaylee, Ethan, and Zana, solely for the way their lives ended, but for the promise, warmth, and joy they brought to those who knew them. Looking forward. Though the scars of that night will never truly fade, the people of Moscow and beyond chose a legacy of remembrance, action, and care. The tragedy served as a catalyst for positive change, proof that, even in the shadow of unspeakable loss, communities can find light, meaning, and resolve to safeguard the futures of others. And so, the town continued, not unchanged, but unbroken, with a pledge that the lives lost would fuel compassion, vigilance, and unity for generations yet to come.